With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I'm your host, Tracy Savage. How about a little music to get this night started off?
The greatest job on Earth, and we're not even on Earth. We're orbiting the world, you see, collecting space debris. Expended rockets, expired satellites, circling the globe, endangering space flight. We're the guys cleaning up the mess, putting astronauts' families' fears to rest. Even a paint chip would take off my arm, traveling at orbit or velocity. Collecting space junk, space waste, space dust. We make it safe for shuttles to fly. Trash men, waveless trash men, cleaning up the crap you left behind. We got hit by Soviet trash last year. From the cosmonauts on Mir. But our worst memory was when we were sprayed by frozen beef. Here's some old bag of toiletries.
What's in it?
Sunscreen and hydrocortisone cream. And the ashes of Gene Roddenberry.
Huh.
Tom Hanks' grip from Apollo 13. Even a toenail would cut off my head, traveling at orbital velocity. Collecting space junk, space waste, space stuff, living the cosmic custodian life. Oh, trash men, weightless trash men, scouring space while trying not to die.
This certainly has been a very busy week in the world of astronomy again, and of course SETI is going to be back online and up and running soon due to public donations. Thank you very much for those of you that took part in that. And of course there was the discovery of the largest black hole ever, which is a real feat for scientists to have done. And to understand that, we would have to talk a little bit more about physics itself and understanding more about Einstein and how time works, because the closer you are to the black hole, well, actually, even being on the moon or, say, a big planet like Jupiter, time is different than it is right here on Earth. So that being said, we're going to get into that in a minute. Of course, there's also the discovery of a planet that would be hospitable to life, as best as they've found so far. Not necessarily us. We can't just get in a shuttle and go on over. You know, it's there's some other more idiosyncratic problems with that, but as far as being hospitable to life, that seems to be the general consensus. But speaking of the physics itself, there is the 2011 Isaac Asimov Memorial debate that occurred in March of this year, and this debate was on the theory of everything. And like I said, understanding more about physics will help us understand about these great discoveries that we're coming upon in our universe. And what these scientists are asking is, can the entire universe be explained with a single unifying theory? This is perhaps the most fundamental question in all of science, and it may be also the most controversial. Now, Albert Einstein was among the first to envision a unified theory that could account for the behavior of all matter and energy in the cosmos, but a definitive solution has eluded physicists to this day. As the 21st century progresses, string theory, co-written by Dr. Michio Kaku, you might remember, remains the leading candidate to be the theory of everything. Although some have come to question whether string theorists are still on the right track, and still others doubt that a theory of everything exists at all, and consider the search for such a theory an outdated philosophy of our search for cosmic truths. Of course, there's basically two camps. You've got, you know, the Stephen Hawking camp, and then you've got the quantum camp. So we are going to join director of the Hayden Planetarium, Neil deGrasse Tyson, as he hosts and moderates six of the world's leading voices in this great scientific debate. The panelists on this recording are Dr. Catherine Fries, Professor of Physics at the University of Michigan, Dr. Jim Gaze, Professor of Physics at the University of Maryland College Park, Dr. Jana Levin, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Barnard College, Dr. Marcello Gleiser, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Dartmouth College, Dr. Brian Green, Professor of Physics and Mathematics at Columbia University, Dr. Lee Smolin, Theoretical Physicist at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. This talk was recorded at the American Museum of Natural History on March 7, 2011.
Welcome back to the what is now our 10th anniversary of the Isaac Asimov Memorial Panel Debate. I'm the host and moderator, Neil deGrasse Tyson, at this institution. Oh, thank you. Here at the American Museum of Natural History, I serve as the Frederick P. Rose Director of the Hayden Planetarium. Frederick P. Rose was... He's a great philanthropist. The entire Rose family, in fact, have transformed the landscape of the city in ways that have brought cultural enrichment to us all. The Rose Center is just one example of them. Part of that philanthropy that was going on at that time involved a way to remember Isaac Asimov. Isaac Asimov is no stranger to readers out there, author of more than 600 books. He is a New Yorker. Did much of his research in the halls of the American Museum of Natural History, availing himself of our library system. And as a fitting memory to his legacy, his wife, Janet Asimov, and friends endowed this series, the Isaac Asimov Memorial Panel Debate. This is our 10th year, but of course that makes it our 11th panel. If you do the math, that's how it comes out. I want to thank Janet Asimov and the Asimov family and friends of Isaac Asimov for enabling this, what has become one of the most successful programs of this institution. I want to publicly recognize them for this. We have elected in this 10th year, 10th anniversary of the series to reprise the subject of the original Asimov panel debate. That original debate was on theories of everything, specifically string theory, and what string theory is, what it means, how far has it come, how far will it take us. We thought that over these 10 years, maybe we should check in on string theory, see how they're doing. Oh, by the way, I meant to publicly recognize that we have 300 overflow attendees to this event in an adjacent room. I just want to say hi to them. Can I hear them? Yeah, there we go. Okay. We have not forgetting about them as well. So we're going to revisit this subject. We have two members of the current panel that were on the original panel. That'll sort of ground us with a 10-year baseline. But we have some new people to bring to you, people who have new ideas about what should be going on the frontier of physics. I'd like to lead off introducing Dr. Lee Smolin. Lee, come on out. Lee Smolin. Lee Smolin is one of the founding physicists of the Perimeter Institute of Toronto, an institute that specializes in the fundamental principles of physics and how they might need to change to give us an understanding of the world that we all hope and expect to have. Next, where am I going here? Get my sheets backwards. Hang on. There we go. Next is Jana Levin. Jana, come on out. Jana Levin is professor of physics and astronomy. At Barnard College of Columbia University, she's a specialist in the early universe, especially higher dimensions and what that means. Higher dimensions always confuses us all. So we're going to find out if she can straighten us out and find out what that has to do with theories of everything. Next out, where are we here? There we go, Marcelo Gleiser. Marcelo Gleiser is professor of physics and astronomy, Dartmouth College. We'll find out a little later that I think he actually throws the whole concept of a theory of everything into question entirely. We'll see where that lands. Next up, no stranger to this stage, he's one of the original first panelists of the Asimov debate, Jim Gates, professor of physics, University of Maryland. Jim Gates, come on out. A deep thinker on all matters from the frontier of physics. I always enjoy conversations I have with him by email, by phone, and in person. The fifth of our sixth panelists is Katie Fries. Katie, come on out. Katie Fries. All right. Professor of physics at the University of Michigan. Katie Fries is an expert on the early universe and especially dark matter and other exotic phenomena that none of us understands. And last and certainly not least is our sixth panelist. Our sixth panelist coming in via Skype. Via Skype. There he goes. Can we hear me on my mic? Yes. Many of you recognize this gentleman. Brian Green, welcome back to the Isaac Asimov panel debate. It's been 10 years and you look marvelous.
Thank you.
So, Brian, I want to lead off with you. It's been 10 years since we had you on this stage. Remind people who you are and what you're interested in and why we might have even asked you to be on this panel at all.
First, I just want to apologize for not being there in person. I meant to be, but something came up. But I do realize there are some advantages of actually not being there in person. You know, should Neil wildly gesticulate, it's unlikely I'll be the guy that gets hit this time. Should anybody say anything that makes me want to roll my eyes, I can actually do so while still being completely polite just by pulling the curtain right across like that. And finally, this is the first event at the Museum of Natural History I've participated in without wearing any pants. All right.
Brian, later on we'll be asking for data on that. Something string theorists are pretty shy on providing, but go on.
String data, yes. I have worked on string theory since I was a graduate student back in 1984, 85, 86. And I think that perhaps is part of why I'm here. And I have a view of where the approach to unifying the laws of nature has been and where it's going. And I look forward to sharing it with the panel here this evening.
So we'll come back to you on that then, if you think that's headed in all the right directions. Because I know we have panelists that think it's the directions it's headed might not be the right way. So we'll certainly have a vibrant conversation about that. Katie, can you introduce yourself to us all?
Yeah, I'm a particle astrophysicist, and I'm not used to being the pragmatist in the group, but I work on the dark side, so the dark matter, the dark energy, dark stars. And in my view, the theory of everything needs to provide answers not only to questions about the four forces of nature, but also about the content of the universe. It's dark matter, it's dark energy. In fact, this is one of the central questions of our time as scientists, and we're fortunate in that it looks like some of these answers are beginning to come in. So, in my view, the theory of everything needs to tie together with the experimental results we're starting to get out of the dark matter and dark energy regime. So to make sure everybody knows what this problem is, when you think about the chairs that you're sitting on, the air that you breathe, the walls in this room, the planets, the stars, all of that, all the atoms in the universe, all the quarks, all the leptons, all that adds up to only 4% of the universe. And we don't know what the other 96% is. So that's what I work on.
Wait, do you work on the 4% or the 96%?
The 96%.
The 96%. Okay, so you're 96%. Steeped in abject ignorance. That's what you're telling us. Okay. We'll get back to you on that. Jim.
Hello, my name is Jim Gates, and in some ways I owe my presence here to Isaac Asimov. As a kid, I was an avid reader of many of his science fiction works, and I even know who Paul French is, and you have to ask the family who that person refers to. As a young theoretical physicist, I had a dream, you know, like, I'm a black man, I had this dream that if I got a chance to do this kind of work, I could find a magical piece of mathematics that was simultaneously an accurate description about things in our world. And I think I'm really close, and I'm going to share with this audience tonight, for the first time in front of any audience, where this place leads us.
How old were you when you first started thinking mathematically about the universe?
I started thinking about wanting to be a scientist when I was age 8. About the time, a little bit before I started reading science fiction.
Okay, so you've been at it for a while. So we expect really great deep thoughts out of you for this.
I wait a minute, you said I've been at it for a while. Why do you say that?
Excuse me. Just a few years, yes. Marcelo Gleiser, yes.
Right, so I am a theoretical physicist, and I grew up in Rio at the beach, but also thinking about the stars. And I did my PhD in string theory and extra dimensions and all those things and postdocs and all that and published papers on it. But after a few years back, I started to think a little differently about our efforts to unify all theories into this single theory of nature. And let me just give you one quick story. There was this week in The New Yorker, there was a short story by David Foster Wallace called Backbone. And it's very briefly, it's a story of this little boy who at 6 years old, he gets this idea in his head that he has to, quote, press his lips through every single inch of his body. And he devotes his whole youth to this. He starts doing all these contortions and he starts spreading his lips so that he can touch every possible place in his body. But then, of course, he looks at the back of his head and the crown of his head with this tremendous mystery, you know, places which are almost sacred. And the story ends basically with a statement, which is that, and he has never for a second doubted that he could do it. And yet, of course, you know, he never can do it. And the point is that in the process of trying to do it, he became a wonderful contortionist, and the pursuit of the goal led him to something. Right? And I'll just leave it at that as an allegory for our session.
Wait. So you get your physics insight from fiction stories in the New Yorker magazine. That's what you're telling us.
Of course, absolutely.
Okay.
Calling us contortionists?
Yeah, are physicists contortionists? Is that your conclusion?
Mine and David Foster Wallace's intention.
We'll find out. Jana. What's been keeping you busy?
Yeah, actually, the past few years, I've been interested in more practical aspects of science. So I work on black holes. But But black holes are real astrophysical objects, and I remember when I kind of made this shift to thinking about black holes as the death state of stars and wanting to work on the possibility that black holes ring space like a drum and actually kind of make a sound, play a song on space itself, and that these are things that we can detect one day, that this was a real shift to real things. I remember thinking, you know, on my deathbed, I just want to work on one thing that's real. I do also work on extra dimensions. I'm very interested in the ideas from string theory or other theories of everything. The idea of extra dimensions actually predates string theory. And the implications that these ideas have for understanding the early universe. And ultimately also the cores of black holes, because these are things that we will not understand without more ideas than the ones that we have in our toolkit right now. So theories of everything are still crucial to pursuing even practical things like, you know, black holes. And so I guess that's what brings me here today. But I also have sort of vague ideas about the general paradigm for why we pursue a theory of everything, or if it's even something that we'll ever get our hands on.
Thank you. Lee, you ran off to an institute where all you have to do is think about the fundamental laws of physics. That's deep.
I'm very, very grateful for that. And thank you. I'm very honored to be here, and also it's very nice to be here. Maybe something that the audience will pick up is that we all know each other, and there's a lot of knowledge and history here, and nonetheless, I learned something about each of the panelists even so far, even as well as we know each other. It's especially great to be here and to be back here because I was a kid just a few blocks from here on 93rd and Central Park West.
Native New Yorker.
Mm-hmm. Native New Yorker. And it's, even though Toronto is the future, is the city of the future, and it's great to be there.
He's a founding member of that institute, so he's got to say all the right things. Yeah.
It's great to be here. I didn't start out like some of the other panelists, or unlike some of them. I didn't start out wanting to be a scientist. I started out first wanting to be a rock and roll musician, and then an architect. And then that led me to a book of essays by and about Einstein that I picked up when I was a high school dropout at about 17. I think Janet was also a high school dropout.
That's true.
So we have that.
Yes. We have that in common.
Now they tell me this before I have them on the show.
And in that book, there was an essay by Einstein. And in it, and he was writing in his later years in about 1950, and he said that there were two problems that he had tried the last years of his life to solve unsuccessfully. And one of them is to make sense of quantum mechanics, which he never believed. And the other is to unify physics, and particularly to unify gravity with the other forces and with quantum mechanics. And for some reason, although I had no interest in being a scientist before that, I read that essay and I felt like I had a mission, and something clicked and said, you know, I'm not very good at math, but maybe I can do that. And that's what led me to be here. And I have to say...
So we need you to help other high school dropouts. This is a remarkable...
Sure, sure. And of those problems... The problem in the foundations of quantum mechanics, when I learned more and was thinking about what to do in graduate school, I decided that was too hard. Although the last few months, I've actually, for the first time in my life, had a real new idea about the foundations of quantum mechanics. But the other problem, the problem of unification, particularly of the unification of quantum theory and gravity, is the one that I decided to work on. And I've worked on that most of my life. I've worked on different approaches to it. I have worked on string theory, which is the subject of our discussion, but most of my work has been on other approaches, what we call background-independent approaches, and I hope that that term and that discussion comes up, particularly loop quantum gravity, but also other approaches. And it's been deeply humbling to have the opportunity to work for one's life on these compelling problems about space and time and what is the nature of nature, as Feynman put it. And I look forward to discussing where we are in that search tonight.
Well, excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Lee. So what we're about to do right now, which is the hallmark of this series, is we're going to break into conversation as though you are eavesdropping on a debate we're having at a bar or somewhere where, or a coffee lounge. Oh, and you're eavesdropping on our discourse. Okay? That's what's about to happen. Brian, it's been 10 years since you were here. I'd like to a report from you on what kind of progress has happened in string theory. I don't read the journals on string theory. And so has there been progress or not? Because some of us were skeptical back then.
And yeah, I mean, there's definitely been progress. One question I do have, is it worth setting any ground basic material? Is everybody in the audience familiar with string theory?
Yeah, can you give us, sure, give us in one sentence what string theory is.
It'll be a long sentence.
Use commas and semicolons. No, just, yeah, so let's lay that groundwork. Go ahead.
In less than a minute, you know, the major developments in physics in the 20th century, as I think many people in the audience know, the general theory of relativity is one of the major developments. That's a theory of gravity, which is relevant when things are really big, stars, galaxies, and so forth. The other major development, quantum mechanics, is for the small things, molecules, atoms, and subatomic particles. The thing is, each of these two theories works in their own realm. But when you try to meld them together, it is very, very difficult to get the mathematics to work. The two theories are, in some sense, ferocious antagonists when you try to meld them together. And there has been a push for a long time to try to meld them, because there are realms in the universe where you need both the theory of gravity and the theory of quantum mechanics. The center of a black hole is a good example. A star collapses to a very small size. It's massive, you need a theory of gravity. It gets very small, you need quantum mechanics.
Because its size is as small as quantum phenomena would require.
That's right. Its size is small in terms of length. Its size is big in terms of mass. So you need both general relativity and quantum mechanics together, and the Big Bang provides another good example. So this is one of the main motivations for trying to build a unified theory. And perhaps as a footnote, I should say, we may have slightly different definitions of unified theory as the evening progresses that may become clear. The most basic version would be uniting quantum mechanics and general relativity, and that is one of the hallmark features of string theory, that at least on paper, that's what it does.
So now, in the past 10 years, has there been much progress on that? Because you look very hopeful back then.
Yeah, no, there's been an enormous amount of progress in string theory. There have been issues developed and resolved that I never frankly thought we would resolve 10 years ago. We've been able to, for instance, crack certain fairly impenetrable mathematical aspects of the theory, allowing us to go far beyond the approximate techniques that were the only thing that we really had at our disposal some 10 years ago. And this is a fantastic step forward. Where we've not made great progress is in making definitive, testable predictions that can be tested. And this has been one of the major issues about string theory for a very, very long time. So let me just be very clear so that the baseline is really set. If you were to ask me, do I believe in string theory? My answer today is the same as my answer 10 years ago, which is no, I do not believe in string theory. I only believe in things that are experimentally proven or observationally proven. Do I think string theory is one of our best approaches to putting gravity and quantum mechanics together? I do, and the progress over the last 10 years has only solidified my confidence that this is a worthwhile direction to pursue.
So you're using the word confidence in place of your belief.
I think confidence is a much better word than belief. Belief, I think, is a murky word. I mean,
okay.
In science, what you do is you have a theory, and you never, ever know whether that theory is right, because you could do 1,000 experiments and they all confirm the predictions of the theory, but the 1,000th and first experiment may not confirm the theory. So experiment after experiment can bolster your confidence that a given approach is correct.
Except we're really just looking for one experiment, right? Not 1,000. We want the first experiment.
Yes.
Right. Jim, we have experiments that can...
Well, actually, I was... Hi, Brian. Good to hear from you again. I wanted to actually break in at this point because, in fact, one of the most exciting parts of string theory may be related to superconducting materials. There's a Nobel Prize that was given recently for a material called graphene. It's a remarkable material made of carbon, and it may replace silicon as we make computers in the future. But in order to understand how this stuff works, you actually have to have a mathematical theory.
Wait, so this graphene was this thin layer?
Thin layers of carbon atoms that have truly remarkable...
You're like one atom layer thin.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Graphene.
Yeah, and it turns out that if you want to understand graphene, there is some evidence that string theory is the only piece of mathematics that can solve certain problems. In fact, the Nobel...
Wait. So there's string theory as a physical concept, then there's the mathematical tools invoked for it. Are you saying string theory, the concept, can apply to graphene, or the math that they're working on is useful to you as well?
It seems as though string theory, the concept, can be useful for understanding graphene. The recent Nobel Prize winner himself was shocked by this.
So obviously he wasn't the one who came up with it. So one of you string theorists knocked on his lab door.
He also said he doesn't like theorists in general, not just theorists.
You contaminate their lab. So Katie, you work in the real world here. So compared to anyone else on this panel, you think about real objects. How do you see this marriage of gravitation and quantum mechanics as mattering, as a goal, as mattering to your frontier on the early universe?
One of the big questions is trying to understand the large-scale structure of the universe. Where do galaxies come from? Where do clusters come from? And it turns out you need quantum mechanics on the tiniest scales, but at the earliest times, to get that process started. So we think there's an inflationary epoch of the universe where it was accelerating its expansion at very early times. And in those theories of inflation, where you take a small patch of the universe, blow it up to be very large, and hence explain...
When you say blow up, you mean expand it.
Expand it, yeah.
When stuff blows up in the universe, that usually means something
else.
Okay, expand.
So it expands faster than the speed of light. And then our observable universe fits inside this giant patch. But one of the big bonuses you get out of this theory is that there are quantum fluctuations on absolutely the tiniest scales, which also get blown up to larger scales, not in the explosionary sense, and can serve as seeds for explaining galaxies and large-scale structures. Without quantum mechanics, on the smallest scales, we wouldn't have those.
So what you're saying is that there's a macroscopic fingerprint that is traceable back to the microscopic phenomena.
Absolutely, and if we're lucky, we can actually use this to test some of the ideas of string theory. In fact, Brian has worked on this, by looking at imprints in the cosmic microwave background.
So we think the cosmic microwave background, this is this residual light signature of the Big Bang, might, because it has signatures of other things going on in the early universe, you think string theory might be there as a signature as well.
Well, we've seen the imprints of these quantum fluctuations on the cosmic microwave background, as well as on the large-scale structure. So those are actually observed. You can see ripples in this radiation. But the details of that, you have to ask, well, where were these quantum fluctuations imprinted? And if it was early enough, you might see signatures of string theory. So there's that hope.
Yeah, sure. So, but Lee, this all assumes standard quantum physics, right?
Sure.
Is that okay? Or are you taking us someplace new?
Well, I was going to contribute to this discussion. I'm happy to go to that discussion later. but because just to get specific, because there's an interesting proposal which has come up in some quantum theories of gravity, particularly in what's called loop quantum gravity, that quantum gravity has a property called chirality. Chirality is asymmetry between left and right, or asymmetry under looking in a mirror. And this is a property that particle physics has, particularly neutrinos in the weak interactions. And
Wait, just to clarify, you're saying there's an experiment you can do on this side of the mirror, and it has one outcome. And if you do the experiment in the mirror image of that, you get a different result.
You get a different result, yes. And that's a result in particle physics. It's now very well understood. The standard model of particle physics, particularly the weak interactions, has that property. Gravity, as a classical theory, does not have that property. Gravity, as a classical theory, is symmetric left to right. Gravitational waves, which are polarized left-handedly, have the same properties as gravitational waves polarized right-handedly. Okay, but in some forms of quantum gravity, that's not true quantum mechanically, and recently some of us have understood that leads to a prediction for the cosmic microwave background fluctuations that Katie was talking about. And I'll say it in language halfway between technical and non-technical language. There are modes of the cosmic microwave background radiation called the tensor modes that, if they're there and if the story of inflation is right, are quantum gravity effects. They're quantum fluctuations in the gravitational field, amplified or expanded or blown up, as Katie was describing. And there is a possibility in the Planck satellite of seeing asymmetries left to right, or parity asymmetries coming from parity asymmetries in quantum gravity in the tensor, in the production of the tensor modes. And this is an experimental possibility that, if it's there, I think would knock all our socks off.
Now, of course, the problem is these tensor modes, although they're predicted by every inflationary theory, in many models are quite small and you won't see anything. And that
can you
go back and rule out?
Now, let me just say one technical point to Katie. If these are there, they're not down by the there's a ratio of how small the tensor modes are compared to the scalar modes. You're usually looking for things which are in the square of that quantity. But if there's...
So what you're saying... Wait. So to clarify, it's not the existence of this in the microwave background that would support the theory. It's the measurement of how much it is relative to...
Yes, but there's also an opportunity, because a parity breaking effect in the tensor modes would show up much before the tensor modes themselves, because they would show up in correlations with the temperature modes.
Huh.
All right, so you're saying...
So
the
it's
current...
a great opportunity for fundamental physics.
So, Lee, the current data on the microwave background is insufficient to distinguish this. You need data from this next satellite,
the Planck satellite.
Which is a European satellite, if I remember correctly.
It's taking data now.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to this.
When will we have these data?
Katie would know better than me.
No, I don't know either. Just 2012. I think.
It's always just a year away.
It's always just a year away.
How'd you guess?
That's better than 10 years away.
Better than 10 years away.
I think that's true.
No, I know. And the thing is really weird that I didn't think that we'd get to such a technical discussion. But in fact, this asymmetry he's talking about is also present in string theory. So I'm not sure it would help disentangle everything at all. It might make the picture much, much murkier.
Let me ask Brian. Brian, what's your best experiment you can suggest for this? Is something in the Planck data that you'll...
You're talking very specifically about astronomical observations?
Yeah. You got some other kind of observation? Observations of the universe.
You're asking about how might you test any of these theories. Yes, I think astronomical observation, that's one promising place, which, again, at first sight is a little weird, because we're talking about theories that deal with the quantum nature of particles, maybe the quantum nature of space and time. Why would we look up there? But, you know, Katie's explanation is good. You know, an allied one is, you know, if I had a balloon that had no air in it and I scribbled a little tiny message on the balloon, it would be too small for you to see it, but blow air into the balloon stretches, you can read the message on the surface of the balloon. Similarly in the universe, if the young universe got imprinted with some of the effects of quantum gravity or string theory, very, very small, but over 14 billion years of the expansion of space, that little imprint gets smeared out on the sky, and you just need to know what to look for. So Lee is suggesting to look for this chiral property of gravitational waves, and they're from the early universe. Calculations that I've done in string theory suggested to look for other kinds of features in the microwave background radiation, which again are very small, too small I think for us to have seen yet, but it could be the Planck-Macy evidence of them. So I'm excited about that direction, but I do consider it a long shot.
Jaina, what's all this about higher dimensions? Could you take us there? Because I live in three, and I...
Right now?
Take us there intellectually, whether or not you visit there physically.
Yeah. Well, it is an interesting concept, the idea that there would be an extra direction that we can't point to. It's kind of a frustrating idea. But you have to imagine that that extra direction is everywhere in a certain sense. So if you imagine a plane, and imagine you were this classic flatland creature, you know, I think it was 1882, Edwin Abbott wrote this beautiful parable of Victorian society called Flatland. And all the characters in Flatland indeed lived in this plane, completely unaware of the third dimension.
Some were triangles,
and your social status is related to how many sides you have as a polygon. You know, the high priests are circles, they have so many sides, and the lowly workers are triangles, and our hero is a square, and women are lines, they have no sides. But it was very satirical.
Yeah,
it was very,
they can only therefore be seen if they shimmy, which was a little
right, bit. They had to shimmy. And coup.
But women are lines.
Yeah.
Lines,
women are lines.
They're only one-dimensional.
This was 1882.
But yeah. No, but you see, he was being very, he was definitely making a social commentary. He was a progressive person who was making a social commentary about Victorian society. But women could kill their husbands if they didn't see them come in edge on, and they could pierce them. So there was a high mortality rate amongst husbands. which I thought was fair, you know. Anyway, so in Flatland
by Edwin Abbott. It's available. It's a Dover reprint. Go on.
But the Flatland is a beautiful job of challenging you to imagine what it would be like to perceive a third dimension if you were two-dimensional. How impossible it would be for a two-dimensional creature to point up. And yet up is everywhere. Everywhere on that plane, there's an up and a down. But those Flatlanders, they can only see north, south, east, west. They're completely unaware of that third dimension. And that would be our situation if there were extra dimensions. We feel like we're three-dimensional. It looks like we're three-dimensional. But there would be these other dimensions that we simply can't point to, are very difficult to describe in any language other than mathematics. Luckily, we can do it with mathematics, which is a beautiful gift. But those extra dimensions would be everywhere at every point in space-time.
So how do you invoke them? How do you invoke them?
Well, so one of the big questions, I think, that...
Look, I don't deny them mathematically. I can go over there mathematically.
But even Einstein started, you know, very soon after Einstein first started to propose that space-time was something mutable and evolving, that it could grow and stretch, expand, collapse. People started asking, well, why should there only be three dimensions of space-time? And so this is a very old idea that really predates string theory, although string theory requires a certain number of dimensions for internal consistency, so it's been foisted back on us again. But the great question is, why don't we see these extra dimensions, which I think is what you're getting at. Why don't we see them? It might be that they're very, very small, literally too small for us to stick our hands in, or it would take too much energy to bust our atoms into that transverse direction, or it might be that we are somehow confined to a three-dimensional kind of a membrane, much like the Flatlanders were confined to their plane. So I think there are a lot of ideas out there.
Okay, that's
fine.
It
might be that they're not there.
What was that?
It might be that there are no extra dimensions.
Like Brian said, it's not a matter of believing in things. You know, nature doesn't care what I believe. But these are very interesting ideas that have some very compelling consequences, and we might not have to wait for the hardest experiments to see them.
What we have to do is go to the highest energies at accelerators to the point where you
currently can, not in America.
Right.
Send something off into the extra dimension.
Right. So the Large Hadron Collider, which got a lot of press because that there was an injunction against it in case a black hole was created and it destroyed the world, which I think is a reasonable risk for the advancement of science. No, I'm just kidding. People were aware of the possibility of making microscopic black holes and things like that. But the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider in Europe, may see signatures of extra dimensions, as Katie's saying. They may get particles going at high enough energy that you can spew something into this extra direction and get a missing signal. Something would suddenly sort of disappear out of your experiment.
So you would interpret that as losing something into another dimension.
Well,
and if that's the case,
possible.
Let me ask you, if that's the case, could there be some other activity going on in other dimensions where they punch a particle through and it shows up in our space? And if that's the case, is that what particles are that pop in out of the vacuum? That we say mysteriously, these are like virtual particles popping out of nowhere? Could we be reacting to experiments gone bad in another dimension?
I can say this. I don't think virtual particles don't require extra dimensions, but you could say something like this, like Marcello and I feel like we're completely independent entities, but actually there's a string connecting us that's going into the extra dimension, and when it intercepts the three dimensions, it looks like a particle here and a particle there that look disconnected, but indeed could be connected.
Yeah.
So the thing that was exciting is that Einstein wrote his paper in 1915, and in 1919, only 4 years after
that... It's the general relativity paper.
Yes, his GR theory. And in 1919, just 4 years after that, this mathematician called Theodor Kaluza said, you know what? If instead of having three space dimensions, we had four space dimensions, I can arrange things in such a way that my theory becomes a theory of gravity, which was Einstein's original idea, and electromagnetism when it's seen in four dimensions. So you go from five to four, and in our perspective of four dimensions, you actually have these two forces, but if you could see them, you know, with five-dimensional goggles, you actually would see them as one. Yeah,
so you'd be unifying the forces in higher dimensions,
right.
And in our lowly three-space, exactly. one-time dimension, it manifests itself as these separate entities.
Right.
Can I say it in a slightly different way?
Sure.
If I look at that lamp, I think I'm seeing light, which is a phenomenon that's completely different from gravity, which is keeping the Earth in orbit around the sun and keeping me pinned to this chair. But as Marcella's saying, the big insight at that time, very shortly after Einstein's paper, was that maybe it's all gravity, it's just gravity in higher dimensions, and that from our three-dimensional perspective, that looks very different from gravity, but it's actually gravity in a higher dimensional universe.
But Marcella, if you're going to tell this story, you should tell a few years after that when Einstein gave up the idea.
Einstein died trying to make this work.
Einstein gave up the idea, okay, for a reason I think is very relevant, and we'll see what Brian thinks, but very relevant for the last years of development in string theory. Einstein gave up the idea because in general relativity, the geometry of space and time are dynamical, and if the geometry of these extra dimensions is dynamical, then they wouldn't stay small if they needed to be small to reproduce the difference between electromagnetism and gravity. They would grow or they would expand.
So they're not stable.
And making them stable has been an enormous challenge that I think we may disagree about how elegantly this problem was solved, but a lot of progress in string theory and a lot of the twists and turns of the development have rested on attempting to solve this problem.
Right. Brian and I wrote a paper together about it.
Wait. I'll get to Brian in a minute. Jim, how many dimensions do you live in?
I live in precisely three spatial and one dimensional. I'm a higher dimensional refusenik.
You're a refusenik of
yes,
higher dimensions.
Yes, absolutely. Because, in fact, it turns out that string theory is actually so bizarre that there are versions of it that don't have higher dimensions. This is not very often discussed, even among the physicists. But in the late 80s, this was actually shown, not as conclusively as some of our other versions, because they're not as simple. So this whole discussion of higher dimensions, I think, takes a direction that one should be perhaps thinking with a grain of salt.
Because what I worry about is you invoke a higher dimension when you can't solve your problem. So it's kind of Band-Aid. Oh, here's stuff you can't see, you'll never interact with. Let me invoke it so that I don't look like an idiot trying to understand my own universe. Brian, how many dimensions you live in?
Well, I think it's a good question. And let me just, I'll give you a number at the end of what I say, but just to respond to what you just said.
Okay, keep us in suspense, fine.
Just to respond to what you just said, it is not at all that we can't solve a problem, so we pull extra dimensions out of a hat.
That it sure looks that way.
Is completely wrong.
I'm glad. I'm just saying it looks that way.
That's fine.
In a higher dimension, it looks that way.
And I'm trying to disabuse you of that misconception. What we do is we follow a mathematical structure that we believe has the capacity to put gravity and quantum mechanics together, this approach that we've discussed, string theory, or Lee's approach is another approach. But when we follow the particular mathematical equations of string theory, they take us to the idea of extra dimensions. We don't go out looking for it. It's an idea that comes to us. Now Jim's point, if you want to discuss it, is a bit of an interesting footnote. In these other versions that appear not to have extra dimensions, they have other degrees of freedom, features that sometimes can be interpreted as extra dimensions. It's a point well taken. But the bottom line is we don't stick it in from the outside. It comes to us from the mathematics. Now,
right.
The actual number, the current version of string theory that we take most seriously, has 10 space dimensions in one time for 11 total space-time dimensions. It's an approach that you may have heard of called M theory. It unites all of the previously thought to be distinct string theories into one unified framework, and that's the approach that most physicists in this field are studying.
I have to ask, was there ever an idea that had more than one time dimension?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So, you know, Itzhak Barz was one of the people at USC who's pioneered this possibility. He has studied theories with two-time dimensions. They're much harder to make work. I mean, if you have trouble thinking about extra dimensions of space, try thinking about extra dimensions of time. I mean, would one of those notions of time sort of align with psychological time and the other would be a different kind of time? I mean, if you show up late, would that mean, oh, yeah, I'm late according to that time, but... but that's really just facetious. There are really mathematical challenges about having two time dimensions that are very, very difficult, but people have studied it and some progress has been made.
Katie, what are you saying?
I was just going to say that the extra dimensions offer us a tremendous playland in cosmology. We have a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So this idea that we're living on a three-dimensional membrane in higher dimensions motivated from M-theory, one version of this is that there would be two such brains at the end
brain,
of the...
Brain, not human brain, but membrane.
Membranes at the end of the world. So that's it. That's the end of the space-time. And in between, only gravity can exist.
Or propagate through it.
Only gravity can propagate through it. So one of the consequences of this is that it makes us look again at the equations in four-dimensional theories. And, for example, one possibility emerges that Einstein's equations in four dimensions have to be modified depending on what is going on in the extra dimensions. Now, this may actually be a good thing from the point of view of trying to explain the dark energy of the universe.
This is the mysterious pressure that's accelerating the expanding universe, that nobody knows what it is.
Yeah, we see these supernova explosions, which are the end products of stars. When stars die, they explode. And you know exactly how bright the supernova are. It's sort of like holding up a 60-watt bulb in the back of the room, so you know how bright it really is.
A standard candle.
A standard candle. But then it's not looking as bright as it should. And so the interpretation is, well, that's because the person holding that light bulb is running away from me. Mm-hmm. So the accelerating universe would be an explanation. And we call this, out of ignorance, the dark energy, this negative pressure that drives this acceleration.
So, but do you need higher dimensions for that? Or maybe you don't know if you need higher dimensions.
We don't know. But it is certainly it is certainly one of the big puzzles that keeps us all working to try to understand what can you do, either using modifications of the equations coming from extra dimensions, or back to Einstein, his cosmological constant that he wanted to abandon, but perhaps here we have this reappearing as an explanation for this anti-gravitational acceleration.
So I want to shift gears a little bit right now, because basically we've been grounded in the kinds of thoughts and physics that's been driving research over these years. But I want to sort of, Marcelo, you came to the Hayden Planetarium a few months ago and gave a talk that dumbstruck many people in the room, because you came at it from a whole other place. What is that place that you come from?
Right. So let me just clarify one thing, which I think is extremely important, that maybe all of you know. But when people talk about theories of everything, in physics at least, we don't really mean everything. You know, it doesn't mean that we'll have a theory that will predict where I'm going to have dinner tomorrow, or if I'm going to have a haircut, or something like that.
So it's a theory of some stuff.
It's a theory of some stuff. And it's really relegated to how the fundamental particles of matter interact with each other. Okay, so the notion that we know now is that there are four fundamental forces in nature. Okay, the gravity and electromagnetism that we know, and two others that live inside the nucleus, the strong and the weak force. So the notion of a theory of everything, or unification, is that we want to bring these four forces into a single force. So that if you look at very, very high energies, i.e. very close to the Big Bang, close to the origin of the universe, you wouldn't see four forces, you would see only one. So that is the pursuit, that if you look at nature at higher and higher energies, hence the interest in the LHC, for example, you would actually start seeing things to look more and more alike, particles interacting in more and more similar ways, all the way up to this unified theory.
So it only looks like four forces because we live in a relatively cold part of the universe.
Exactly. Right?
All right, so Einstein died trying.
He did. He spent, 20 years trying to unify only the electromagnetic and the gravitational interactions into a theory in four dimensions, as Lee was mentioning there. And would people nowadays would say, well, you know, he couldn't have succeeded because he left two very important forces out. We now know that there are only four forces of nature. And I start thinking, well, how do you know that? Well, that's what we measure. But how do we know about nature? Well, exclusively through our measurements. You know, what we need in order to make sense of reality is our tools. And a lot of discovery in physics, not completely, but a lot of it is very much dependent on the accuracy of our instruments. If you look at the history of quantum mechanics, for example, it wouldn't have happened if we didn't have the right machines, the right laboratory experiments, to force people, brute force people, into thinking in a completely different way than they were thinking before. It was a real time of drama in physics where the old folks would not want to give up the notion that everything is deterministic and ordered, but experiments forced them into this. Einstein, when he came up with relativity, he had very specific tests of his theory. And eventually, when the tools were allowed, were there, people went out, measured, for example, during a solar eclipse, you could measure stars and look at their position with respect when the sun is not in the path, and you find a little distortion which has to do with the curvature of space that he predicted would be there. So a lot of what we know of the universe depends on how we measure things. And to me, the problem with the notion of a theory of everything is that it implies that we will eventually know everything there is to know in the world of particle physics only, that we're going to have tools that will be able to give us all the answers that we're looking for. And I do not see how that's possible. For example, let's say we succeed with a 11 space-time dimensional superstring theory, which is a wonderful thing, and I'm completely in agreement with Brian that it is about making it falsifiable, making it testable, and that's perfectly okay. What bothers me is not getting there. What bothers me is saying that that is the answer, that is the theory of everything, because very possibly a few years from now, a new machine, as has happened on and on and on in the history of physics, will reveal something completely unexpected that will need new ideas for us to keep going. So for me, physics is a work in progress, is a narrative, is an ongoing effort for us to understand nature.
The endless frontier.
The endless frontier.
And if it's endless, you then can't have a theory of everything.
Right. You make your knowledge grow like an island, you know, but then the shores of ignorance increase.
Wow. That, I had to stop it there. Unfortunately for you guys, you have to wait till next week to hear the rest of it. The 2011 Isaac Asimov Memorial Debate on the Theory of Everything. Can there be a unifying theory? Well, these prominent physicists are discussing just that. And we're going to stop right here. Like I said, that's about it for Savage Science Radio this week. I'd like to thank Nick Palucco for the beautiful show graphics. Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for that great intro I use every week, and Todd Sheets, magic man behind the controls at Jackalope 105 FM. Until next week, keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails to you.
Every morning, I grab my donut and coffee, and I sit down at my screen. Nothing gets me going like the possibility of knowing there might be an intelligent extraterrestrial message for me. Every day is the same. We don't hear anything, but we like to play Sudoku. Lately we've been into live action role playing games. We know it's only a matter of time before we finally find intelligent life. Saying hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
What is your planet like?
Well, all right.
Have you cured all disease?
No.
Have you achieved world peace?
No.
Is your skin pale green?
No.
Do your spacecraft come with tractor beams?
No.
Do you wear shiny clothes?
Rarely.
What about long flowing robes?
Well, actually, right now I'm in my boxers.
Oh. Well, how many intergalactic languages do you know?
Well, I did take French in high school.
French? Hold on.
Okay.
Can you specify your exact location?
In Canada.
Canada.
Broadcasting from my little shortwave radio.
Know how to speak English anyway.